Hello, book club members. Welcome to our second podcast conversation for Jesus and the Disinherited by Howard Thurman. I'm here again with Dr. Walter Fluker. And you're about to read the chapter on deception. And so I want to tell you, this conversation is not happening in real time. This conversation is happening immediately after our last conversation, the last podcast that you heard. I want to say that with devastating sincerity. And that's great news for me, because if you listened to our last conversation, you know there was so much goodness there, and it's a privilege to keep it going. So thanks for being willing to keep on talking, Walter. We are about to read, when the listeners hear this, they will have just read the chapter on fear, the first Hound of Hell, and they're about to read this week the chapter on deception, hypocrisy. So I want to ask you a couple specific questions about how you work with with Thurman on that. You already talked in our last conversation about how this kind of disease of fear it continues to be such a huge problem in our world. There's a place where Thurman talks about the difference between confusing fear for caution and caution for fear. And that kind of caught my attention, because I was thinking about, there's that famous little clip called, it's called something like How to Get Home Safe. And it's like the 10 rules for African-American kids to get home safe. And it's pretty devastating to watch. It's not a talk that I, as a white Canadian, have ever had to have with my kids, right? So how do you think about the difference between fear and caution in America, in the world?
I think what Thurman is asking us to think about, and the way in which I receive it and interpret it in the 21st century, is that fear is not just the encounter between two individuals or even a small group. It would be a mistake to leave the conversation there with Thurman. Thurman is thinking also about the ideological entrapment of fear, ways in which fear is internalized, almost as a habit, or I was trying to help one of my sons understand habitus, and so I'm going to try it out on your listeners.
Love it.
The things we inherit from culture, which have already structured us before we arrive. It's like inheriting a haunted house filled with ghosts that scare you all the time. Thurman is interested in this kind of ideological entrapment of fear, especially among the disinherited, who have for centuries had to deal with the devastating presence and impact of fear. So yes, black parents, I've had the conversation with my children, my sons, when they first started driving in Atlanta, because we moved from the north back to Atlanta. I said to them, when a white cop stops you, please put your hands on the steering wheel. If you have time before he gets to the car, turn the radio to NPR. Find some classical music. And use your best white voice.
Oh, man.
Don't have hip-hop on, because you don't want to frighten him. Because he's already afraid of you. And this is why he's treating you, often treating you, not all, but most of the time, it's because of deep fear of what you represent. And for Thurman, he's such a wise, he's a craftsman, because he's playing with this, and he's playing with his readers. He's writing this book in 1949, but he tried to publish the book in the late 30s, but was rejected. And I don't think you have to think a long time to figure out why it was rejected by a publisher. And he had lectured on this for quite a while, since 1935, as far back as I can trace it. So he's thought about these things, These are not new things for him. And he grew up with this. So he reverts to nature. He's such a trickster. Please, Rick. He talks about this quivering rabbit that the hounds have tracked down. Or the dog who is so frightened just of the gesture of a rock.
Yeah. All it takes.
So the reaction is there. So I walk into our time, but the anatomy of fear for Thurman goes back into his heritage, his habitus, his situation, where he's been taught to stand in fear. The great early historian on African-American slavery, Kenneth Stamp, has a chapter that's worth reading. As old as this book is, I just thought, to stand in fear. The slave driver's job on plantations was to make people stand in fear. The early police departments, especially in the United States, I can't speak for the rest of the Western world, were related to slavery, especially in the South, and to make them stand in fear. So Thurman knows this is an inherited disposition, a habitat, so to speak.
Yeah.
So how is this related? I'll be asking readers to think about how is this related to questions like power, and an awesome word that we don't use in regular language a lot, but I'm thinking of Judith Butler for readers who are interested in that kind of thinking. What about precarity, precariousness? That is, I'm always vulnerable. To be human is to be vulnerable, but there's a kind of precariousness which social and political and ideological forces perpetuate my vulnerability. Kind of read Thurman through these lens, because it's related to power. And some ways the power of ideology, which has been internalized. And so parents, and I imagine some brown parents and other kinds of parents, or the parents of immigrants in countries like Canada and all over Europe, sit down and say, be very careful, my daughter, be very careful, my son, because you're vulnerable. And you're vulnerable because of the way you look.
Yep.
And so with that in mind, I'm thinking a lot nowadays about, with Thurman, about how we understand freedom. Freedom is related to power. And Thurman is suggesting that our power resides within us. Somehow, even though we are trapped in the ideological spirals of precarity and all those big words, we have this locus in the human will. When unleashed and disciplined, is power. And it's power mainly not to react to the action upon you, not to react in kind. He wants us to make a qualitative distinction between the kind of violence that perpetuates fear and one's reaction to the action, where one operates out of one's own freedom and center, and this notion of truth or integrity that is part of overcoming deception, right? So I hope I haven't leaped too far into the future with this, but how do I maintain my integrity?
Right.
Unless I act not upon the action upon me, but I react from the core of my very being, because in many ways I'm condemned to be free. Some ways Thurman is like Sartre. I'm condemned to be free because there's nothing that my oppressor can ever do to me that can take away that. even to the point of death. So he says truth telling is the only recourse.
that I must
be sincere.
And he does seem to be saying, at least in my reading of him, help me if I'm off track, but there is this liberation for the individual to say, to not use the coping mechanisms of fear and deception and hatred, and to have this personal integrity, this personal liberation, this radical freedom you saw when he read Mark in Jesus. Mm-hmm. But also he seems to be suggesting that's ultimately how reform is going to happen, because to not react to the abuse of the oppressor is to undermine the power of that abuse, right? Is that, like, that's where the act...
David gives Goliath a stroke, brings about a stroke. Because he's standing there, a little kid, and not afraid of him.
Yeah.
But this is a very costly endeavor, though.
Huge.
There's a song in the 60s, Otis Redding. People will recognize that name, Sitting by the Dock of the Bay. He had another song, something like Shout Bama Lama, but it's, don't mind the title. a refrain goes like this. The preacher and the deacon were praying one day, and along came a bear coming down their way. The preacher told the deacon to say a prayer. He said, Lord, a prayer won't kill this bear. We got to run for it. So Thurman is advising against the survival ethic of deception.
Yeah.
All of nature deceives. Children even deceive their parents, he says.
In a kind of social contract. Right,
like in a social contract, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's a little sexist. He's a man of his era, but he says women do the same. and that may be true, and my God, how well men do it. But it's the point is that this technique of survival, which the disinherited have learned out of their reality, their social, their existential, their historical reality. They've learned, in order to live another day, I must trick this oppressor. I don't think it's always a bad strategy. How can you do that with integrity? I often think of Aristotle with courage. Aristotle says, now, it's one thing to stand in front of a locomotive and say you're courageous. It's quite another thing to be run over or get in the way of a locomotive because you're trying to save someone. That would be courageous, right?
Right?
Thurman's note on caution, I think, points us to this, but he doesn't develop it.
Right. Well, that actually leads me to, I wanted to ask in this, in the deception chapter, which folks will be reading the week they're listening to this, I wanted to ask about, he seems to, tell me if I'm reading him right, not to have any room at all for, like his,
compromise.
Yeah, for it. Yeah. So I wanted to make sure I understood his three options when it comes to how people are going to use or not use deception. The first one is to say, forget about it. It seems like, you know,
kind of apathetic, like an ostrich hiding its head in the sand. It still leaves a lot exposed.
Yeah, and it's just that the oppressor and the oppressed have agreed to a contract of deception to make things work, right? And so let's just, it is what it is. It's kind of option one, right?
And you know me.
Yeah, we're just going to wink at each other and keep this rolling. And then option three, he calls complete and devastating sincerity. And that seems to be the option that he's endorsing. Option two is this compromise where you're striving for integrity, but you're going to make some allowances. And he seems to be saying the problem is if you make don't get killed the center of your life, that is not a transcendent enough center. So that's why he rejects option two.
I think you're reading Thurman correctly.
Okay. So grappling with that, how do we think about, so a couple years ago in the book club, we read The Hiding Place by Corrie Ten Boom. Mm-hmm, and there's a scene where she lies about the fact that she's hiding Jewish people from the Gestapo, and her sister-in-law has a Christian conviction that you should never lie. So she actually outs the Jewish people that they're hiding. And that's a complicated conversation about deception. So did I hear you say a few minutes ago, there may be cases where if you're lying for the sake of the other, or there's a compromise for the sake of the other, that there is some integrity in that, would you say?
That's what I'm suggesting, that as a point for conversation with Thurman, I think that's the option that he brings up, and it's really negotiation.
Right.
I know you, you know me, and that's the way it's going to be, right? And but that's death to the soul for Thurman.
Yeah.
Over time, I find ways to resent you, and I think he used the illustration of the Pharisees.
Yeah.
I often think of the James Smart's transcripts, hidden transcripts. He says when the great Sultan parades down the street, the poor serf bends over and farts. Yeah. It's an act of resistance.
Yeah.
Right. Contempt. Right. It's resentment. And Thurman thinks that's death to the soul.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the best of all possibilities, but he's also providing us with a divine, in his language, imperative.
Right.
That in order to truly be free, this is this idea of freedom in Thurman, and to have a sense of deep integrity, to know oneself profoundly, one must respond in truth. So, two examples. One is, this is the question that Sue Bailey Thurman asked Gandhi in India in 1936. She said, what would you do if someone came into your home and was going to rape your wife and your daughters? Gandhi said, I'm not a very good practitioner of, I think they were talking about ahimsa, but I would pray that I would have the strength to maintain my truth.
Wow.
Paraphrasing, and we have that in the first volume of the Papers Project, this first meeting of African Americans one-on-one with Gandhi.
Huh.
That's Thurman. The other illustration is Thurman himself. Thurman returns to Morehouse College to teach in the late 20s. This is after studying with Jones and others. And there are riots in Atlanta. There were often riots that weren't reported.
Hmm.
And the custom was, when there were riots, someone would sit on the porch as a watch person overnight. And Thurman, when his turn came to watch, he said he sat there with a shotgun in his lap trying to figure out what he would do.
With a shotgun in his lap.
So
there's some lively options.
Yeah. I'm not pushing. But is what he is telling us something that can guide our moral deliberations around deep questions of how do I respond to violence? I think it's worth a try, and the reason why I think it's worth a try is because I'm also a student of King.
Hmm.
And if anyone, along with Gandhi and a few others, but if anyone has really tried this, it's been King.
Yeah.
And he paid the high price. Thurman writes King in late 1966, before the assassination. And he's responding to a letter from King, who is thanking him for a donation to Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And he closes with the most ominous note. Hmm. He's quoting an author, and the name escapes me now, but he quotes, he says, "Remember, Martin, that those who hunt for treasures at night must leave a drop of blood." Because he was aware of the danger it is to stand in the public domain and not just to talk, but to embody truth. So yeah, I think this is where Walter lands. Yeah, I think it's our high calling. I think it's our high call. And I think that every now and then there's a traveler, kind of a biblical reference, but every now and then, I think there's a traveler who points the way.
Yeah.
Who points the way. But the ambiguity, the contingency, the problem is that with the shotgun in my lap, it's not the same as writing a book. So the preacher and the deacon were praying one day, and along came a bear coming down their way.
Right.
So that's part of the challenge. But I think it's left for us to make some decisions about how we want to respond, especially to this time. Thurman thinks in the 1970s, 75, one of his last lectures, 76, because it was bicentennial, at the University of Redlands, a speech entitled America in Search of a Soul. This is also the year of the busing issue in Boston and around the United States. He says, I think school is out for America. God has allowed this country, blah, blah. He goes on with a great metaphor of America as a school to learn democracy. He's just playing with people. But he, at the end, he's so disappointed that we have not learned our lesson, even though people like King and others have tried to point to a better way. So as early as 1976, Thurman has already kind of signed off in many ways about ways in which we understand this democratic experiment. He said he thought school was out for America. And then he closed the sermon, and it's kind of hard to hear. It's like he's exasperated. I think school is out. So that doesn't leave you with a lot of hope, but he loved the tragic. He loved Tolstoy as well. He has a great sermon on Tolstoy.
Right, right. Do you know if he had any engagement with Bonhoeffer?
No, I don't know, and I wish I did know. But he certainly knew Bonhoeffer, knew of Bonhoeffer, and being with Niebuhr, of course, but I don't know. I don't know that. And I've not seen any research to suggest the same. That's a good question for me to ask a few people, though, who are doing this. There's a great book by Reggie Williams on Bonhoeffer. It's a kind of a black theological gaze at Bonhoeffer, Reggie Williams. I think, and it's Bonhoeffer in Harlem. And some of the lessons that Bonhoeffer learned from African-American activists and religious figures while he was in Harlem. I think you love the reading.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
But Thurman isn't in that conversation as far as I know.
As far as you know. So it makes me want to ask you, as a student of Thurman and King, if in 76 Thurman is exasperated, thinks that the experiment might have run out of steam, the school is out, where are you? Do you have hope?
Well, the last thing I want to say, but only because it occurs to me, Andrew Young preached Sunday at the First Congregational Church here in Atlanta. And he helped me to recall that King's last sermon, the sermon he planned to preach at Ebenezer Baptist Church on that Sunday, which would have been right before his death, was Why America is Going to Hell. Whew. So I think hope exhausts itself. It feeds on itself. My response, and this is also, I think, Thurman's response. You keep hope alive only because hope has to feed on itself. And this part of this kind of metaphysical thing he's doing with life. Life is alive, says Thurman. That's a tautology, right? Mm-hmm. But life itself is alive. And he says that the most obvious thing about life that we often miss is that life is alive and that life is not dependent on human initiative, human adherence. If we don't pull this off, he says God is infinitely resourceful and that God can create a new civilization out of an anthill. That's not a great word for humans, but even in his ecological critiques that date back to 1939, Man and Nature, he thinks that human beings have become fowlers of their own nest. And is very concerned. In the 60s at St. John's the Divine, he's so concerned of what will happen when nature itself has to, correct some things. Maybe in this podcast or another, we can read Thurman's The Growing Edge, which is the way he thinks about hope. He really thinks that the contradictions of life are not final.
That's a good word.
That there is a growing edge.
I love that. We are going to get more time with you. We have the pieces that you've given us throughout the book club, and then we're going to have a live webinar with you where readers can submit their questions and continue to kind of tease out the treasure of your lifelong conversation with these giants. So we're very grateful. But I do want to ask you, as we close this conversation, is there anything that isn't expressed in the pieces you've given us or that we haven't talked about yet that you want us to hold on to as we engage with Jesus and the Disinherited? Anything else you want to put on our radar?
Well, let me share this. No, I don't right now, but you gave me so much. I'm thinking about Bonhoeffer. I like Bonhoeffer. One of my mentors and teachers at BU, Walter Mulder, was a good friend of Bonhoeffer's and others. And he said Bonhoeffer was a fool. That was his reading of Bonhoeffer. Why would you do this? That was his reading. One of the things I like best about my Lutheran brothers and sisters, their inheritance from Luther and Augustine, is that they take sin very seriously. Going forward, we might ask, how does Thurman understand sin? And is sin an error of the mind, this kind of rationalist projection upon human nature? Or is there something indigenous to the will that holds us in bondage, that may prevent us from being our best selves? How does Thurman reconcile it? Maybe the readers can help me. Because I think I take sin seriously. And I am a sinner. I mean, I don't relish in it, but God, I have so many contradictions. Sometimes I try to go north and south at the same time in this body, and it's a strain on the anatomy. So I'm always in this situation where I'm tempted to sin. And is sin the right word? Does sin have a place in the 21st century? Will Thurman help us understand this better? So that's what, the moment you said Bonhoeffer, I said, yeah, I feel you, man. I feel you. I feel you.
Good things to hold. That makes me want to ask, I don't know if I'll include it in this podcast, but as soon as you said you want to go north and south at the same time, I'm thinking of Paul saying, why do I do what I don't want to do, in the Pauline epistles. And that's striking to me in Thurman, his reading on Paul. For you, would you ever preach from a Pauline epistle? How do you interact with Apostle Paul?
I preached earlier this fall on Paul's What Shall We Say Then? And Thurman has some things he preaches from Paul. His big issue, and you can read this in this book I just told you about. He does some work with Paul several sermons. He says Paul is constructing this Christological symbol, which we inherit from him, but he's really wrestling with his own Jewishness, as mm-hmm. was Jesus for Thurman. Mm-hmm. And so this arises out of Paul and his struggle with the law and et cetera. And that's not a new interpretation, but it is a modernist interpretation that I think we've inherited. I appreciate Paul's struggle of the body of death is what I like to play with. The body of death. Paul calls it a body of death because it inhibits him from the light and the life that is his. And he needs grace, the grace of Jesus Christ to rescue him. Oh, foul thing that I am, this body of death. You know, he goes on and then thanks be to God, Jesus Christ. Okay. And I love that. I'm interested in the body, and I'm interested in the body from a necrophiliac interpretation. And by that,
you're going to need to say more about that.
Yeah, we live in a culture that is in, we live in a culture that is in love with death and destructiveness. And those who suffer most are these, the ones who are unborn. I always want to remember those. But those who are on the other side of the equation, the disinherited for Thurman's language. And what do you do with a culture of death? I mean, a love of death, thinking of Eric Fromm, biophilia, necrophilia, all of that. But the language now is translated more and more into systems. And systems that perpetuate a vicious cycle of death. From West Virginia, the closing of coal mines, post-industrial United States. I'll let you have Canada and my European friends have the rest of the world. But here, this pandemic, for me, is part of this kind of necrophiliac movement. Because there are so many things we could do to curtail its spread. But what is it about us? Our, is it our avarice? Is it our pride? Do those words make sense now? Or are we all kind of caught in the web of the spider? And for me, it's an awful time for that. And we need some glimpse of hope. We were talking about hope. We need someone to say, okay, there is a way to live in this. I think Thurman is our guy in respect to that. There is a way to live in these contradictions, in this death. I think he's good for that. I'm not sure he's the best in providing very specific remedies and strategies. That's not his project. I think you want to pay attention to the Bonhoeffers and the Kings and the Fannie Lou Hamers and the Ella Bakers, in my tradition at least, or the Dorothy Days and others. You need to kind of watch them, because that's not Thurman's project. He has a huge pad. It's a macro pad that he's painting on. And it's a map that gives us a sense of the territory. But for those who are doing the work in the territory, you might want to get some guidance from them.
That's fair.
As you're reading through Thurman.
Yeah, so good. And such a reminder of why we need the community, why we need each other, you know, and different people working on different projects and coming together. Yeah. Well, that sure makes me grateful for you, for your project, and for this time with you. Thank you so, so much.
God bless you. It's been wonderful. Let's do it again.